Good afternoon. So before the break, we introduced sort of set associative caches. We started with these direct map caches, which were the simplest cache design we've talked about. We had this strategy in these direct map caches where we had sort of one place for every value in memory, and because our caches were smaller than memory, this meant multiple things from memory would map to the same sort of row, which we called a set of our cache. And we'd figure out which row something mapped to by taking some bits of the address we called the index. Now, of course, we had some other bits of the address. So at the end of the address, we had an offset. And this arose because we decided we'd take groups of values together. This was to take advantage of spatial locality. So we'd have these blocks that we'd store for memory in the cache, and we determined where we were in a block with the offset bits, the last bits of the address. And it was bits because we always chose a block size that's a power of 2, so we could always sort of chop off the bits to get the block number in memory consumption. And since we only had so many rows in the cache, but we usually had sort of more blocks in memory, we also had some extra bits in the address we didn't use to determine where something went in the cache. And we need to record this because when we were looking something up in the cache and we found there was a value, we need to know, well, did that come from the same place we're trying to find? Or is it some other value that just happens to have an address that's kind of close? And we had the tag was our information that wasn't used. We could have sort of achieved the same effect by storing just the full address we were looking up, but that would store extra information we don't need. Because if we know what row it's for, we know what the index bits are. And if we know what, and we, the offset bits we know always range from 0 to the maximum, so we don't need to store that either. Then we extended our direct map caches to these set associative caches. And one way of thinking about a set associative cache is that if it's a k-way cache, we've stapled k direct map caches together. And when we do a lookup, we'll have a set that's kind of a row, which is, you know, straddles across all these k stapled together caches, and we'll check each of them. And if it's not there, we'll insert in one of them according to some, what we called a replacement policy. Because sort of our lookup is the same for each of these caches, we still have the same idea of splitting up the address into a tag, index, and offset. The difference is when we get an index, get a row, we have multiple blocks to deal with instead of just one. And then we started talking about mapping sort of accesses in C code to caches, and we were focusing primarily on accesses to the data cache because that's the thing that is sort of you have more obvious control over as a C programmer. Your code also makes instruction cache accesses, but it's a lot harder to do meaningful things about that in the way you write your code. And one issue that came up that we realized is that usually we're accessing values that are multiple bytes, and those can kind of be split across blocks. And at least for like single integers, we really don't want that to happen because that means that when we read one thing, we're actually accessing the cache twice. That's going to be slower. And we call these cases where our values are misaligned. And it turns out our compilers deal with preventing that scenario. But that doesn't mean they lay things out optimally for the cache blocks. So we saw an example where we were looking at an array, and we said, oh, well, the array could start in the middle of a block. We still wouldn't have the array elements overlap blocks. But it could start in the middle of a block, and therefore could span 3 blocks instead of 2, which would be a little less efficient. And this is generally not something the compiler will optimize automatically because, well, optimizing it means adding extra space to pad things to the beginning of a cache block. And if it did that all the time, you'd be very annoyed. Why is my program using 50% more memory now? So the compilers generally will not do that. They'll do enough work to make sure that when we're reading like a 4-byte int, it's not going to be at the end of overlapping two cache blocks, but they're not going to like make each array sort of use the minimum amount of cache blocks and things like that. Okay, so questions about things we covered last time? Yeah?
Question about this, actually.
Question, do the end and beginning of block get used less often than the rest because we need to not overlap a cache block? No. The way compilers ensure things don't overlap cache blocks is by sort of choosing their addresses to be multiples of the item size, which ends up making a lot of use of the beginning and ends of cache blocks. And so what you'll see compilers do, so I don't know, does CSO1 cover struct padding? So if you remember struct padding in CSO1, this is why this is a reason why compilers like doing that. And if you don't remember struct padding from that, if you have a struct, and let's say I have a char A and an int B, the typical layout of this will be that I'll have A, some unused space, and B, and that unused space is precisely to do this alignment thing, making B be a multiple of 4, if ints are 4 points. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay, so one logistical note. So page table 2 is due next Wednesday before the lab because we have a code review exercise where you're going to be showing people your code in lab and getting feedback on it, and you need to submit your code before that. And I will mention, this is showing people your code. They are there to give you feedback on like code style, maintainability, and things like that. They are not there to debug or write your code. It's not part of the lab. So it's due before the first lab. The late policy does not apply to this. If you submit after the beginning of the first lab, you will not get credit unless you have a very special reason. There's some extra stuff for page table 3, which is not intended to fit in 2 to 3 days. I just have the page table 2 deadline as late as it can possibly be. But that doesn't mean you shouldn't start page table 3 before that. The extra things you need to do in like the README file and so on. So questions about page table 2 logistics? Okay, so I'll go over one thing on the quiz. I'll go over other things with the question. So question 1, we had some code which had a for loop that did n iterations, and then an accessed a of I, and another for loop that did n iterations and also accessed a of I. And we asked whether having n would increase the temporal and or spatial locality. And it's going to increase the temporal locality because when we think of the code here, we access something in A, and then we access it again in the next for loop. And how far apart those accesses are in time depends on n. The smaller n is, the closer those are in time, the better temporal locality we have. And we'll actually see this with a real cache, in that if we make n small enough, our array will kind of spit in the cache, and we'll get cache hits in the second loop, and if it's too big, we won't. So the caches will actually take advantage, in many cases, of this extra temporal locality when n crosses a certain threshold. So questions on that answer? Yes?
The code will not work the same. Like, it won't come out with the same answer.
Question, the code will not come out with the same answer? Indeed, the question was not asking whether it would give the same answer. It was asking whether the temporal locality would change. Yeah? So the question is, let's say I tried to preserve the same answer, and the way I did that is I had a for loop that did n over 2 iterations, another for loop that did n over 2 iterations, that was a duplicate of these two, and then I did that again. So it depends what the order is. So let's call this first thing. Okay, I didn't expect the interpretation that we somehow like change that and half it and also make it compute the same answer somehow. That's not what I was going for. I was just going for, does this change to this code increase the how well the caches help run it fast? But let's say I call this first loop sort of star and this second loop exclamation point. So if we're doing like those two things for the first half and then those two things for the second half, So if that would also improve the temporal locality, right? Because we're doing everything for the first half, then everything for the second half. So that would have better temporal locality. And that is an actual strategy that you'll see used in like matrix code, is like trying to divide things up like that to improve temporal locality. Yes?
So in my comments, I said it depends on the size of n, the size of n over 2, and the size of the cache.
So you said it depends on the size of n and the cache. So I agree the performance does, but remember locality was a concept which didn't depend on the cache. It was something caches took advantage of. But whether something has temporal locality is just, when we see a value being accessed, does that predict that the value will be accessed again soon? It doesn't depend on whether the cache can take advantage of that or not. So it's a property of the code, it's not a property of the system it runs on. Does that answer your question? So indeed, there's examples of locality we can see where the cache will not take advantage of it. There are caches we know won't take advantage of it. That doesn't mean it isn't locality. It's just locality is kind of a way the program is predictable. Okay. Other questions? Okay, and other questions on the quiz in general? I have slides for, yes.
I have a question about the least recently used Raven. Like,
okay.
I just wasn't sure if that was the data go in the spot that was least recently used, or do we avoid that?
Does the data go in the spot that's least recently used? With a least recently used replacement policy, it goes in the spot that's least recently used. And now that spot is used, so the LRU waybit would change as a result of that. So the question was asking, I believe, if I remember the question correctly, it was asking what, the thing we asked about it was a row, the cache set had both options available, so it would replace the least recently used one. I don't believe we specifically asked where the data would go, we just said it, so it was sufficient to know it would go in one of the two places, and the LRU waybit has to change, because once we replace it there, now we just use that, therefore it is no longer the least recently used. Yes, we were supposed to replace the least recently used thing, and because it was just used, that changes what's least recently used after that. Other questions? Okay.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Is it possible to get partial credit on some of the, like, type in the answer things based on your comments?
Is it possible to get partial credit on some of the type in answer things based on your comments? It should be. I'm mostly delegating grading to TAs, and my primary concern with question grading is that we're consistent.
Okay.
So.
And that doesn't require a regrade request, right?
It should not require a regrade request, but you are welcome to make one.
Okay.
My hope is the TAs, regardless of whether there's a regrade request, are looking to justify the grade based on what was submitted before any regrade requests. Other questions? Okay. So last time we ended up with this example, so let's do another example of that type. And we have a convenient assumption here. We're going to assume array 0 is at the beginning of a cache block. We have 8 byte blocks. Our integers, this is going to be 4 bytes. So if we think of how this array works, we have array of 0, array of 1, array of 2, array of 3, and this is one cache block, and the elements 2 and 3 are another cache block. The array spans two cache blocks with this layout. question is how, and we have a one set direct map cache, so the simplest cache we could have, basically. I'm asking how many misses, assuming it starts empty. Give you a little bit of time to check with your neighbors that you agree on what the answer should be. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks, I think not most people, so who thinks we could have one miss, two misses, okay, three, four? Okay, so plurality say four. Because the problem says that everything uses the array, I can't really make an argument for more than four, and I get four, which, if you remember from last time with this situation, we got two. So we have twice as many misses, and an intuition for why this happened is that we have worse spatial locality here. That previously, when we were accessing an element of the array, we were very likely to access something next to it very soon. That is now less likely because we're sort of staggering our accesses around. And the way this manifests with our cache is that we read array of zero, and the way our cache works is that it's going to bring in zero and one because that's one cache block. The cache is not smart enough to realize what's about to happen. Then we read array of two. The way the cache works, we're going to bring in two and three because that's one cache block, and we only have one place to put it, so it replaces zero and one. Then we read array of one, and too bad, we just replaced it. So that's going to be a miss, and we're going to replace 2 and 3 with 0 and 1 because we assume it's going to be accessed again. That's how the cache works. Then we read array 3, another miss, so we have 4 misses. Yes?
When writing code, is something worth thinking about? Like, will it save us time while I'm writing all other code? Yeah.
So, question, when writing code, is there something worth thinking about? So, if you care about performance and you're dealing with enough data that sort of filling up the cache is going to be a concern, then yes, it is worth thinking about. If you don't care about performance or you aren't dealing with enough data that like we're going to have things being evicted from the cache probably is not really a big deal. Answer your question? Yeah.
Is it guaranteed to be a miss when you're like accessing a variable for the first time?
Is it guaranteed to be a miss when we're accessing a variable for the first time? So the depends what we mean by variable. But the short answer is no, and we can see an example here where we're accessing array one for the first time. And this is our prior example, we did it in order. And that's a hit.
I meant array,
when accessing array for the first time, well, we could have another version of that situation, like if we have like an array and we have something else, and like our cache blocks work out something like this, right? We could have the same that same sort of situation with things which aren't the same, just because they happen to be close to memory. But with the caches we know about, it seems like the first time we access a cache block, whatever things are in it, that's going to be a miss. And this is what you might see in the reading called a cold miss or a compulsory miss. So it turns out that the processors use do have strategies for avoiding those misses, but we haven't discussed how those work. They need to do something that we haven't talked about caches doing. And the most common technique is something called prevention. Are there technique questions? Yeah.
Does the cache always load data, or does the cache always load data on just reading, or does it also do it when you write data?
Question, does the cache always load data on just reading, or does it also do it when you write data? We will talk very specifically about the writing question later. The answer is it depends. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so let's say we have a bigger array and a bigger cache. So now I have a two-set, so two-row direct map cache. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks we're gonna have two misses? Three, four, okay, five, six, seven, eight misses. Okay, so we have pretty much agreement on four. And there's multiple ways of figuring this out. I'm gonna show kind of the sort of a very systematic way of figuring it out. And that's that I've just said, okay, so array, I'm gonna assume, to keep things simple, that array of zero is index zero. It turns out this reasoning works if it's index one. I just swapped zero and one a bunch of times in this picture, but I get the same answer. Because I'm only counting misses, don't care which column things go into as long as it's consistent. And I'm just tracking, we read array zero, that's set zero, so it goes in there, and that's a miss. And then we read array one, we look in set zero, see if it's there, it is, it's a hit. And I keep going, using the appropriate set in each case. An observation I'd like you to make is that if we think of how this works, like, I didn't actually kind of need to do as much work here, because there's some shortcuts I can take to kind of analyze subsets of this problem. And one of those is that I can say, well, some of these accesses only go to set zero, and whatever happens with set one is not going to affect them, because when we're doing those cache accesses, we look in row zero, we never look in row one. So I can just analyze them independently. So I can just analyze 0, 1, 4, 5 independently. I can do the same thing for the set 1 accesses, 2, 3, 6, 7. And I can also take the shortcut of saying, wait a moment, these are the same pattern, so it's going to be the same answer, and I don't really need to do this analysis if I can prove that to myself. But we can kind of look at each set independently, figure out what happens, add them together, and get our final answer, and not have to actually sort of track the whole cache contents for the whole process. Now, for this problem, that doesn't make much of a difference, but if you wanted to reason about something much bigger, this would be a way of doing that practically for very regular patterns like this. Some questions about reasoning here? Okay. Let's do the same extension of this one. Who'd like some more time? Okay, so who thinks we have four misses? Five, six, seven, eight. So most people say eight. That is what I get. So I have sort of the fully worked out version here, where I've just sort of said every step, what happens to both sets. I have, and I also have my sort of mapping to sets of their array. And again, I could do this without sort of doing the whole mapping by saying, I'm going to do the things that go to index 0, then I'm going to do the things that go to index 1 and just add the misses together. Because I know they're independent of each other. Yes?
So is more ways always more powerful than having more sets?
Question is, more ways always more powerful than having more sets? No. So remember, for a couple reasons. So the most obvious reason is that the most natural way of getting more sets gives you more storage, right? Which is more powerful in a certain sense, right? These are, like, if we had added, we didn't compare two sets to two ways in one set. We compared two sets to one set with both with one ways. And the other thing is, like, whether how well the extra storage you get from adding those ways works, like, depends on how our replacement policy lines up, which isn't always going to be the same as if we used extra sets for those storage. Yeah?
So, like, at least in this example, it takes the same amount of storage to have a two-way one-set as similar to a two-set one-way. And if you have a two-way one-set, we don't we won't have eight misses.
So the question is, if we have a two-way one-set, we won't have eight misses. So that depends on our replacement policy. So let's think of, that depends on our replacement policy. Let's say we have an LRU policy and we had a two-way one set. So let's actually just do that exercise. So let's say, cross this out, we do two-way one set cache. Let's think about that. How many misses should we have? And I need to specify the replacement policy for us to do this. So let's say with an LRU replacement policy. Who'd like some more time? So who thinks we're going to have four or fewer misses? Five? Six? Seven? Eight? Eight. We still have eight misses. And the way I'd figure that out is, I'm sort of tracking what's in the cache. So we have one set, so I can't split things up. Everything's in one set. And I'm going to write the set, what the contents of the set, I'm writing array indexes 0 and 1, and I'm choosing to put whatever way is most recently used leftmost in the way I'm writing this, and then least recently used, even though we know in the cache, yeah, we wouldn't like actually like move things around, the data around, we'd like just change an index, but it's easier to write down just moving it around. So when we access array of 2, that's going to bring in the cache block containing array of 2 and array of 3, and that's going to be the most recently used, which means 0 and 1, which we previously brought in, is the least recently used. Then we access array of 4, and that's going to bring in 4 and 5 as the most recently used, replacing 0 and 1, because that's the least recently used. So note that all of these were misses. We access array of 6. That brings in 6 and 7, replacing 4 and 5. Another miss. And we're going to have this pattern where we continue to have misses. So we access array of 1. That's not in our cache. It replaces 4 and 5. And we have another miss. And we just kind of are chasing our tail over accessing something we recently evicted. So having additional ways didn't help us in this case. Now, if we had some foreknowledge of the future, we could make the two-way cache work better by choosing a replacement policy that maybe doesn't make much sense, but will work for this situation. So if our replacement policy, instead of being one focused on locality like recently used, was I'm going to keep the lowest array index in, then we could have a higher hit rate by saying we're going to keep in 0 and 1 the whole time. Now, that's not a very good replacement policy for most programs, but we could make it work better. If we make it work better for this specific example at the cost of probably making a whole bunch of other programs work worse. Yeah? So you're right, oh, I didn't do that. That we could change this pattern. Like, so if I would consider just the case where, you know, we had only these accesses, for example, right, then in that case, yes, the two-way would perform better than the one set. The two-way one set would perform better than the two-set cache, because in the two-set cache, all those accesses map to one set, which gets overloaded. With the two ways, they still map to one set, but that set has more options. So yes, there are cases where, and the cases that come up in real programs that are actually not uncommon, where more ways with the same amount of storage will do better. It is not a guarantee.
But is there a case where two set one way is better than one way two set?
Is there a case where two set one way is better than one way two set?
Yep.
We can construct those cases too, yes. So as an example, so I guess if you want an example of how can we construct a case where two set one way is better. So in a simple example is, let's say I access array of 0 and something and a bunch of things that map to the other set, array of 6. And interleave that with array of 0, right? So if this is my accesses are like this, then with a two-set cache, we have a hit for every access to 0 after the first one, but the accesses to 2 and 6 are all both misses. With a one-set cache with two ways, we're kind of doing the same chasing our tail thing, where we're always evicting, accessing something we recently evicted, and we'll have all misses. So this would be an example of a pattern which will have which would perform worse with the two-way cache. Now, when we have a LRU replacement policy, that usually we expect that to do better, and in practice it usually does better because it takes a better advantage of locality, but it's not a guarantee. Does that answer your question? And I guess I didn't write this. So this is like with the two set, this is set zero, miss, set one, miss, miss. Set zero, hit, set one, miss, miss. And that would continue going on with the two-way. These would all be misses, the same reason as the pattern here was misses with two-ways. Other questions? Okay, so we'll skip over. Let's do a different example. Yes. To which examples? These? I don't have those answers prepared. I can ask answer on Piazza or later or something like that. I don't have them immediately prepared. So here we're asking to expand to a much bigger cache. And the hint tells you the answer depends. So we want to give what do you think is a plausible thing that can happen. And another observation to make that's very deliberate in this problem is that this is exactly 2 kilobytes, and this is exactly 2 kilobytes, which is the same amount of stuff this cache can store. So the cache can store, potentially, one of the things the cache can store is the whole one of these arrays. Who'd like some more time? So anyone want to volunteer an answer? And because there are multiple possible answers, we can... So optimally 256, how did you get that? Okay. Yeah, so you're saying
you get 3 hits per miss.
You get 3 hits per miss. And another way of thinking about it is that we have a total of 256 blocks to access, and we can access it where we access a block, do everything with it, access the next block. Yeah, so that's 512 blocks, because there's 4 kilobytes and divided by 16 bytes per block. Blocks. Not 512, sorry. 256 blocks, yeah, each accessed once. Each accessed one miss plus 3 hits. So that is indeed the optimal case. That was our best case. Anyone want to tell me about a bad case? Yeah. One hit and 3 misses. How did you get that? Or so what causes the extra misses? Like, what's your? Let's start with that. So your concern is the two arrays could sort of interfere with each other in the cache. And I guess let's talk about the optimal situation. For the optimal situation to not have interference, we want to be accessing array 1 of I, you know, like here, while we're accessing array 2 of I somewhere else in the cache. This represents sort of our rows of our cache. But the bad case would be when we're accessing a particular part of the array that both of them go to the same place, same row of the cache. And that can only store one block, because this is a direct map cache. So that's either going to be the one from array 1 and array 2. And if we look at the loop, well, they're going to change places. So we'll actually have every access be a miss in that case. And we end up with 1,024 misses. So that is our worst case. So the best case is they map to always in different sets. The worst case is they're always the same set. And you can construct some cases that are in between by saying they sometimes that the arrays kind of are don't start at the beginning of a cache block, so they're sometimes in the same set and sometimes not. Questions on this? So this inconvenience is a reason why we might want associativity in our caches. And also, there's a particular case I showed you, mentioned last time, where this comes up in reality, which is like if we're storing like a 2D array that's flattened in memory, if the size is a power of 2, often the things will be spaced out exactly right to cause this problem between different rows. And I mentioned associative caches like kind of solve this problem, but only so much, right? Because we think of, here I have memory in our associative cache, right? Our associative cache has the same issue that things that are in the same set, you know, only map to sort of one little part of the cache, you know? So with a three-way cache, that's not a problem if we only have 3 of them, but if we're accessing like all the things that map to the same set, we're still gonna run out of space eventually. Just gonna take longer. Hopefully too long, but if we have that sort of matrix case, where we're, you know, if we're accessing these two things only, we're fine. If what we're doing is we're accessing a value here and here and here and here, we're going to have problems. we're gonna get probably the worse performance from our caches than we expect, even with three ways. And I'll skip some of those exercises for time. So last time, when I'm mentioning this, like when I introduced direct map caches, I showed you sort of these simulation results that are in blue circles on this slide. Of sort of, this is for a binary search tree lookup. This was the cache hit rate, and the line represents the size of the cache. So basically, if our cache kind of behaved ideally, after loading, everything would be a hit, because that was before that line, because it all fit. That does not in fact happen. And we see that if we change from a direct map cache to a two-way cache, that we can see that, well, a lot of those misses probably were because we had this kind of sort of accidental sort of matchup of sets. That the nodes of our binary tree happened to have addresses that mapped to the same set, and that got us into trouble. And adding extra ways helped us avoid that more often. I also showed this example of matrix multiply, and here our n represents that it's this n by n matrix. And we had this phenomenon where we had these sort of big outliers on values that are related to powers of 2. Some of these are obvious, like this big outlier here is on 64. And it happens when you're advancing by 64 elements to go down a column that, well, you don't use as many sets of the cache. We have that same phenomenon where we happen to go to the same set, and that causes this big spike in cache misses. This also happens less obviously for some other values where we don't go sort of as precisely to the same sets, but we still hit the same set repeatedly more often than usual. And we can see here that making it associative, I should use a different color. Making it two-way associative made that better, but it didn't entirely remove that sort of effect of sort of having these values which would tend to map to the same sets. Because even though we had two ways, that wasn't enough to hide that problem completely. Because we still had things not using all the sets of the cache. Okay, so questions on these sort of overall pictures of set associativity? Yeah?
Is there almost a little splash to 64?
What? So the question is, why is it also higher around 64 but not exactly 64? And that's because even though it's not exactly 64, when we add 63, if we start in the middle of a block and we add 63 a bunch of times, we'll still end up in the blocks in the same set a little earlier a lot of the time. So we still have a higher number of these conflicts. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So I promised we'd deal with another topic, which was about writes. So we talked about reading from the cache, but caches need to deal with writes. We'd kind of be annoyed if we could only read memory, and except for the instruction cache, which does not need to deal with writes, we need to worry about that. And there's two decisions caches need to make about dealing with writes. And processors make different decisions when they design their caches for both of these decisions, depending on their specific needs. So those two decisions are, what do we do if there's a write and it's a miss, meaning the value is not in our cache? What do we do about that? And there's two options. So there's the option that says, well, it's a miss, we should load it in our cache. And that's what would make sense from what we saw with reads. We assume that there's a miss, we should load it in our cache. That option is called write allocate. There are some caches which don't do that. They do something called write no allocate, where they say if it's not already in the cache and they're trying to write to it, don't bother loading it. And kind of the assumption they're making there is that we're not going to read it later just because we're writing it now. So if you think that assumption's true, write no allocate's a better policy. Also, it might make implementing write simpler. here's a second decision. If it's a right hit, meaning it is in the cache, when do we update the next level of cache for main memory? So the simplest option is to update it right away, that we want main memory to have the right value, so whenever you update something in the cache, we'll also update the next level. And this is called write through. But this has the problem that, like, when we were doing caches, we were trying to avoid always talking to, like, main memory in those slower caches. And this write-through policy seems to violate that policy, violate that rule, that we are talking to them for every write. Seems like writes won't get much faster. So we can instead have a policy where we'll update it later. We'll defer that update and do something called write back. We'll write it back later. And a big intention in doing this is that if it's updated multiple times, that we should only update once. If multiple updates sort of maybe only send the last version, send the final version. So like if we have a counter that's being kept in our cache, you know, if it stays in the cache while we're counting up to 1,000, maybe we only need to send the 1,000 version sometime later. We don't actually need to like send each of the intermediate values. That's like going to be a big advantage of this write back policy. Okay. Questions? Sort of these basic two decisions. My vocabulary terms for them. Yeah?
What does next level refer to?
What does next level refer to? So we talked about having our processor talks to a L1 cache that talks to an L2 cache that often talks to an L3 cache that maybe other processors talk to. It's whatever the cache is attached to go to actually get the value from either a bigger cache or main memory. Is that answer your question? Yeah.
When you're saying writing to cache, are you saying that like the program wants to write to memory, but instead of going all the way to memory, we're just going to write to cache later?
So the question, when I say writing to cache, is the program thinking it's writing to memory? Yes. So remember, the way our caches work is that when our processor wants to talk to memory, it doesn't talk to memory, it talks to the cache. And the cache is responsible for talking to memory on its behalf. Question, what if we wrote something to the cache and later the cache overwrote it because it was fetching something else? The cache is responsible for tracking those sorts of conflicts. So it's responsible for knowing that if you write something to something that it's trying to read asynchronously for some reason, it's responsible for resolving that by doing enough bookkeeping. As we've talked about caches, that doesn't seem possible because we've talked about caches as sort of something where like they do one thing at a time, but it is true in practice actually that caches like will do multiple things at the same time. And yes, they have to deal with all the bookkeeping for that to make that look consistent to the processor. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so let's talk about this first decision about write allocate. And the reason why this is an interesting decision is that usually when you're writing to the cache, you're not writing a whole cache block. Usually we're like writing 4 bytes, but our cache blocks might be like 64. And this means that it's not straightforward to just store the thing you're writing in the cache, because we need to store a whole cache block. So we need to get the remaining bytes of the block and around the written part so we can actually cache that whole block, because we don't have any way of notating. I have this thing cached, but only the middle part of it. There's no way of indicating that in the cache. We have to get the whole thing. And so this is a reason why some caches have been motivated to use this write no allocate design, where they say, I'm not going to bother fetching things when you're writing. I'm just going to send it through. So our write no allocate policy, our processor is going to say, hey, I'd like to write this value to this memory location. And Sorry, I will need the right now allocate. I write this value to this memory location, and it's just going to send it on to the memory, not do anything with it, assuming it's not already cached. There's nothing to update. In the write allocate case, it's going to cache it, but we also have to cache the block around it. So we're going to end up loading the rest of the cache block into memory, into the cache from the next level. So that means our write is going to have this read attached to it that we have to do. So questions about the implication of this write allocate idea? Yeah?
For the write allocate, it only overwrites part of the block?
First one, for the write allocate, it only overwrites part of the block? So the reason we're only overwriting part of the block is because that's what the processor asked us to. So if we were lucky and the processor was giving us instructions to replace the whole block, we wouldn't need to do this because reading the rest of the cache block would be reading nothing. Yeah. Unfortunately, that's not most of the programs you write. Because, you know, if you think of X, you're usually modifying like 8-byte variables, not 64-byte ones. But in some cases, it might be avoided because we're actually writing the whole cache block. Other questions? Okay, so we have the simpler write no allocate is the other option if we don't want to do that. And if we think we're gonna overwrite the whole cache block anyways, maybe this makes more sense. Because, you know, why bother reading things we'll never actually read back again? So that is the decision if the value is not in our cache to begin with. Then we have a second decision about, which is or write through versus write back. And this is, comes up if for any reason the value is in our cache. So there's two ways this could have happened. One is that we could have read it earlier or read some other part of that block earlier. Another is that we could have a write allocate policy, and after the write allocate policy applies, we need to say, okay, now I've loaded the data, where do I put it? And we have these two decisions about when there's a write, where do we put it, if it's in the cache. We're definitely modifying the cache, because you'd be really annoyed if you modified a variable and that modification, and then read back the variable and didn't see that modification. So we're definitely modifying the cache. The question is, are we also modifying memory yet? So the simplest policy is write through, and that says we're going to modify the cache and we're going to modify memory right away. So we don't have to worry about fetching it later from memory or the next level and getting the wrong data. The other option is write back. And this option we say, well, talking to memory is slow, I'm not going to do that. I'm just going to modify it in the cache and record that this block is dirty. And here I'm indicating sort of one byte is dirty. When we actually implement this, we're going to have to mark the whole block as dirty. We're not going to have like per byte data on what's dirty. And eventually, we have to get this back to the memory, assuming we forget about it. So if the value stays in our cache forever, we never need to tell memory about it, because, well, we're always going to have the right version of it. The problem is, what if the program starts accessing other stuff, and we want to free up some space in our cache that's storing this 1-0? So in that case, it's getting replaced by something else. We have to send the thing that is dirty to memory so we don't forget about it. Because you'd be really disappointed if you like wrote to a variable, did a bunch of other stuff, and then read from the variable and didn't see the thing you wrote. That'd be very bad. So we have to make sure the value survives by writing it back if we would forget about it in the cache. And this dirty indicator tells us when we need to do that, because we don't want to do it every time we evict something, because it turns out most of the times we evict something, it hasn't been modified. There's no reason to write it back, so we'd be doing a whole lot of extra work if like we always wrote it back. So in this case, our read of something that needs to evict something is going to cause a write and a read, a write of the thing we wrote to the cache earlier and a read of the thing that was actually requested to replace it. Okay, questions? our write back policy. Yeah?
So, for using write allocate, that changes the cache. Does it also go ahead and change the memory? Or is that.
So, question, if we're using write allocate, does that mean that we update the memory immediately? That is a separate decision. So first we figure out, if the value's in our cache. And write allocate is going to tell us the answer is always yes. So the decision about whether memory gets upgraded is whether we're doing write through or write back. Most commonly, you'll see write through combined with write no allocate and write allocate combined with write back, but this is not necessary to combine it in that way. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So if we think of how write-back's going to work with our cache, we're going to have an extra bit per block in addition to the valid bit saying whether that block is dirty. And whenever we modify something in the block, we're going to mark it as dirty. So we know that if we evict it at some point, we replace it with something else, we need to write it to the next level so we don't forget about the changed value. So as an example here, let's say I have a write allocate write and write back policy, and I'm writing the value XFF to address 04. So 04, that's 0000100. We have one offset bit and one index bit. So this goes to index 0. And it has tag 00001, which is not in there. So it's a miss. So since it's a miss, and it's a write, we consult our write allocate versus write no allocate policy to decide what to do. Our policy is write allocate, so we're going to add it to our cache on a miss, which means that we have to actually add it. So we're going to find the least recently used block of the cache, and of the set, I should say, and that is the one with way one. I'm assuming we're labeling things. This is way zero, this is way one. So that's what we're gonna replace. So to replace that, we need to get rid of this from our cache. And previously, the way we got rid of stuff from our cache is we just overwrote it without caring about it. But now we have this dirty bit. So we need to look at the dirty bit, and it says, yes, you need to write this back to the next level. So we're going to need to actually write to a different address to handle this write, to write the updated values of memory at 60 and or 61. Then we're going to have to read in the rest of the cache block. So I wrote OXFF to 04, but our cache block is 04 and 05. So I need to get 05 in there, so I'm going to get that from memory. And I also need to update the LRU information, and note that I'm marking my block as dirty because I have FF, which I haven't written to the next level in there. I need to remember that eventually we want that to go to the next level, assuming we, at some point have to get rid of our storage of 04 and 05. Questions about this process for kind of our worst case right here. So write no allocate, if it's not in the cache, it doesn't add it. So the subtle distinction is that we could have that with write back here. And in this case, we'd say it's not in the cache, we're not going to add it, but that doesn't mean that if it was in the cache, like, we would still write it and mark it as dirty. We're just not going to add it if it's not there. Other questions? Okay, so let's do... this little exercise in our last few minutes. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, a bunch of people. Okay, so since we have time-wise, I'm just going to go through explanation. So writing one byte to 0x3, that's set one. So it's in this set. And it turns out, or set one, so it's in the second row here. And it turns out we already have the value cached. We're just modifying it. So we're going to modify it here. We aren't going to read or write the next level. That's what the question is asking about. Just modify cached value. If we had a write-through policy instead of write-back, or then we would, in fact, modify the next level, but write-back says we don't do that. We would have to mark it as dirty, except it's already marked as dirty, so we have no extra work to do. Reading one byte from 0x52. So that value is, we'd update the LRU information. So we would do that. Because now zero is least recently used. So if we were writing from 5.2, that ends up going, replacing 0x33, so we'd have to write back 0x32 to 0x33 because it's dirty, and we'd also have to read in 5.2 and 5.3, and we'd update the LRU information because we put something where in the least recently used slot, which was way 1, so now way 0 is the least recently used. Then, if we're reading from 5.0, that's going to replace 0x30 and 0x31, because that's the least recently used way, and that's not dirty, so we don't need to write it back. We're just going to replace that and update the LRU information. So questions? That. Okay, so next time we'll do our last topic about caches, which is going to be about TLBs, which are special caches for page table entries, and then we'll start talking about threads.